My dear friends, these are not very propitious times in which to report on a visit to the Soviet Union. The international weather is very foul at the moment. And whatever one says is likely to be misconstrued. I would therefore like to remind you that prejudice is a poor listener, even if it is a bad reporter. I should also like to point out that hatred in international relations is a bad counselor. I have visited the Soviet Union 3 times since its founding. Once in 1926, when the country was slowly rebuilding itself after the ravages of revolution and the chaos of civil war. That was before the first 5-year plan had been launched, and before the forced collectivization of the peasant holdings had begun. I was in Russia again in 1935, on the eve of the bitter struggle within the Communist Party, the notorious public trials, and Stalin's bloody purges, which ushered in what has been aptly called the years of fear. When I visited Russia for the 3rd time last July, Stalin had been dead for some 8 years. The 20th Congress of the Party had exposed and downgraded him, and Russia, which had emerged victorious from the Second World War, was now a recognized world power, second only to the United States. On each occasion of my visits, I saw a different Russia. So many things changed during the intervals, changed outwardly and changed inwardly. The basic text, of course, of the Soviet government has always remained unchanged and sacrosanct, and so did the fundamental socialist structure of the country. But like all sacred texts, life forced upon it many radical commentaries and interpretations to meet the exigencies of changing conditions and the ineluctable facts of experience and reality. We flew into Russia from London in a few hours on a Soviet jet plane. Actually, the very plane on which Yuri Gagarin, the Russian hero, who was the first human being to orbit the globe, the very plane on which he had arrived in London that very morning for an official visit. Subsequently, all our travels in the Soviet Union were on these fast Soviet-built planes, which are as fine as any in the world. We were lodged by the Intourist in an imposing new hotel in Moscow. Our room had a fine view of the Moscow River and of the city itself. Soviet hotels, the best of them, whether in Moscow or Leningrad or Kiev, by Western standards, are second class. The service is slow and offhand and on occasion non-existent. The menus in the dining rooms promise many interesting items, but only a few of them are unfortunately available. But the tourist gets enough food, even though the choice is limited. We were intrigued to find in the hotel lobbies, wherever we went, in the dining rooms, full of visiting Asians and Africans, many of them in their native dress. Some of them were members of visiting theatrical groups, dancing groups. Others belonged to delegations which had been invited as guests to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union actively cultivates these visitors and guests from Africa and Asia. There is no color line in the Soviet Union. African dignitaries are not subjected to the humiliating experiences that some of them have experienced in the hotels and restaurants, unfortunately, of our own country. While we were in the Soviet Union, President Nkrumah of Ghana and the President of the Sudan were on special visits to the Soviet Union. They were received with all honors. The streets were decorated with welcoming flags and streamers. In Leningrad, we attended a superb ballet performance, the Blue Danube. And the President of Sudan attended this performance and was escorted to what you might call the royal box. He was warmly greeted by the audience and welcomed by a soldiers' band which played the national anthem, both of Sudan and of the Soviet Union. The Russians do not miss a trick to win the goodwill of all the dark races of the earth. One of the amusing sights we saw in our hotel lobby in Moscow was an 80-year-old man who was dressed as an African prince in the full regalia of colorful ostrich feathers, headdress, and a cloak of blue and green and gold. He carried a racing stick and binoculars. Upon inquiry, we were told that he was actually a bogus prince called Monolulu, a racing tipster who went about displaying a sign which read, "Horse racing will stop all wars because as soon as a man backs a winner, he becomes a capitalist." And I thought that Monolulu had something there. We spent 3 weeks in Russia, principally in its three largest cities, Moscow, Leningrad, and Kiev, and their environs. Of course, these three cities do not represent the whole of Russia. In a sense, they are its showcases and its best supplied areas. There are parts of the Soviet Union which are out of bounds for foreigners. This is especially true of the villages and small towns which have not yet been readied for tourist inspection, and which have remained very much what they were in Zara's days. No sidewalks, no pavements, deep mud, and tumble-down hovels, although they have all undergone a marked cultural and social revolution since those days. There were many things in the Soviet Union which we did not see, and no state secrets, I assure you, were revealed to us. They tell the story of a Russian who insulted a public official and called him an idiot. He was promptly arrested and was fined 21 rubles. 1 ruble for insulting a public official and 20 rubles for revealing a state secret. There is much in Russia that the Soviet Union is not ready to boast about, and much that it boasts about that is not entirely so. But if your eyes and ears are open and your heart is not filled with prejudice, and if you did not go there just to prove a point and to exclude all else which does not fit in with your preconceived notions, you will learn much, very much, about this startlingly different, challenging, and exciting new world, and a new way of life, which have brought the whole of mankind to new crossroads of destiny. Were we spied upon when we were in Russia? I've frequently been asked that question since my return. Were agents looking over our shoulders? No. We were not aware of being followed or being spied upon. We used guides whenever we wanted to go to places or needed interpreters, but we did not have to take them along. We could look about for ourselves and did look about for ourselves without guides. We walked the streets freely, watched the people at work and at play, saw how they were dressed, entered the shops and stores, saw what people were buying and what were they paying for their purchases and the quality of the merchandise. We went to concerts and theaters and sports arenas and cinemas and cultural and recreational parks. All by ourselves, we saw the small outdoor markets and what housewives were carrying home for their family dinners. We saw the open-air bookstalls and what people were buying and reading. And even when we visited a state farm or a pioneer camp or a huge factory and were taken by the director on a tour of inspection, and listened to his explanation and the answers which he gave to our questions, we could always check and recheck on the information which we received. No one needs to be taken in if he bears in mind that what he hears is never the entire story, and what he sees is not all that there is to be seen. On the other hand, you quickly realize that all about you are unmistakable evidences of real achievement and of great construction. You feel the pulse of a dynamic and intelligent people at work, and you see how they are earnestly experimenting not only with new techniques of production, but also with radically new social programs and ideas. In the cities which we visited, the construction of buildings, apartment houses, schools, factories, hospitals, sports palaces, new streets, and the widening of old streets was going on at a remarkable pace.
Gigantic hoisting cranes and tractors
were everywhere in sight.
And I was told by reliable informants, many of them Americans and Europeans who had visited other parts of Russia, that this was true of other cities in the Soviet Union as well, where new industrial cities, and vast industrial projects were being built, especially in Siberia, whose limitless mineral and water resources were being systematically and rapidly developed. These may be taken as facts. Whether the Soviet Union is outmatching the United States in this or that field of production, in steel or meat or milk, is really of little importance except to Russian propaganda. But the achievements are very impressive in themselves. Oil production has risen in Russia from about one-fifth to about one-half of that of the United States in a few years. Steel production has increased by 70% to 65 million tons. And while Russian progress in other fields of industry has not been as marked, Russia, for example, produces fewer cars in a year than the United States does in a week. Nevertheless, its total industrial output is rising sharply every year. The government is deliberately concentrating on the production of heavy industry at the expense of light industry, concentrating on its military establishment. And this has been responsible for certain marked industrial imbalances. But it is clear to any observer that industrially, Russia is definitely on the march. When one recalls that only a few decades ago, this country, under the Tsars, was 80% mujik, peasant, that it is now the second most industrialized country in the world, the transformation must be viewed as truly remarkable. One could speculate, of course, whether as much or more could not have been accomplished in 44 years by a progressive and democratic government without the costly and tragic social upheavals which took place under communism. But such idle speculation belongs to those intriguing and unanswerable ifs with which history abounds.
The Soviet
has not been equally successful in its agriculture. Its collectivized farms and its state-operated farms, for whose establishment so much of peasant blood was spilled and such an appalling price in human suffering was paid, 4 million kulaks, that is the richer peasants, were either liquidated in the process or exiled, and millions more of peasants perished from famine in the course of their violent resistance to collectivization. I say that these farms, of which such a costly price was paid, they are not fulfilling the high hopes
which were entertained for them.
And here I believe that communism
may be facing its greatest defeats.
With one half of its population on the land, Russia scarcely raises enough food to feed its people on an adequate diet. The United States, with far fewer people working on the farms, produces huge surpluses.
The Russian people,
one sees on the streets in the large cities, appear to be better dressed and better shod than before, than I saw them before. And the shop windows on Gorky Street, which is Moscow's main thoroughfare, but on the main streets of other large cities, the shop windows now cater to the universal feminine love of style and elegance. The Russian people are not averse or disdainful of the material things of life, which they know to exist far more plentifully in capitalist society. They themselves would like to have more of them. And their government is increasingly under pressure to provide more and more of consumers' goods, which are still very scarce in Russia and of inferior quality and very highly priced. I was told that they are somewhat more plentiful today than they were before and cheaper than before, but still not plentifully enough and certainly not cheap enough. Great shortages still exist in many essential commodities. The story makes the rounds in the Soviet Union. This story makes the rounds. St. Peter asked Stalin, which hell would you like to go to when you die? The communist or the capitalist? The communist, by all means, replied Stalin. I'm sure there will always be a shortage of fuel there. The privately owned automobile, which is a commonplace for America, is very scarce in the Soviet Union. But it has a particular fascination for many Russians, especially for the younger people. We watched out of our hotel window, when I say I, you should always substitute the word we, because Mrs. Silver was along with me. I slept along with her to all these places. We watched out of our hotel window in Leningrad a crowd gathered around an automobile which an American tourist had brought with him to Russia. And day and night, curious Russians circle about that automobile, studying its every feature. There was everything there except the symphonic music with which American auto manufacturers announce their new cars every year. Now, transportation is very cheap in Russia. It isn't that the Russians can't move about. There are tramways and buses and taxis and very plush subways. But the private car is a rarity. And even if a man has the thousands of rubles which are necessary to purchase a car, he must wait 2 or 3 or even 4 years to obtain one, for the output is extremely limited. The housing problem is very severe. Many houses were destroyed during the war, and the big cities have received an enormous influx of people from the country. And while many new apartment houses are being constructed annually in a crash housing program, they have not met the demand by any means. The average family, and it's true of all over Russia, must live in one room the size of a small bedroom and must share kitchen and bathroom facilities with 4, 5, or 6 other families living on the same floor. Some more fortunate families have a one-room flat with a small kitchen and bathroom all to themselves. They are the more fortunate. Somewhat more generous provisions are made for important public officials, specialists, managers, artists, and others belonging to the new elite. So there's a new class, the elite class, emerging in Russia. Some of these people even have small summer cottages, dachas, in the country. But private homes, even very modest homes, such as are enjoyed by millions of our people in the cities, towns, and villages of America, are practically non-existent in the Soviet Union. The standard of living in Russia is below that of the West and considerably below that of the United States. Wages are low. The average wage is between 80 and 90 new rubles a month, about $100. Some receive more. Scientists, writers, professors, academicians. An academician will receive as high as $2,500 a month, along with other perquisites. Wages in Russia are scaled in six categories. Not all Russians receive the same pay. But the average wage, even for the skilled worker, is low by our standards. But rents are cheap, very cheap. 6 or 7 rubles a month, including utilities, food, can be obtained in factory canteens. Food, while plain and rather monotonous, is not high. Medical, hospital, and dental care are free. Education is free for all children, all the way through college. Workers get vacations, paid vacations, and old age pensions. And the factory, where a man works, which functions something like a self-contained community, provides him with, the large factory, provides him with many cultural and recreational facilities, free of charge or at very low cost. So that one can manage, especially if there is more than one earner in the family. The wife works, her child, along with the husband. Russians do not feel the need to save for a rainy day, for sickness, for old age, or for the education of their children. They enjoy a sort of cradle-to-grave security, minimal as it is. If they save, and many of them do save, it is for something special that they want to buy. A piece of furniture, a new suit of clothes, or to save for travel, or for a television set. Television sets are very popular in the big cities of Russia. Women enjoy equal status with men. They share in all things, even in hard physical labor. We were unpleasantly impressed with the sight of women carrying heavy loads and laying bricks in construction work, wielding pick and shovel on the highways, sweeping the streets, loading and unloading freight. We were told that the work, even in mines and all branches of heavy industry, these women are evidently attracted by what the jobs pay. Official discouragement of the practice is only half-hearted. There is a shortage of workers in Russia. due to the great manpower losses which were sustained in the Second World War. Also, the output per Russian worker is well behind that of an American worker. And so women are wanted in industry. On the other hand, all careers are open to women. One-third of all the teachers of the institutions of higher learning are women. One-third of all the members of the bar and 40% of the judges in Russia are women. Thousands of women are directors of industry and are farm experts. Of the 360,000 physicians in the country, 300,000 are women. The women are not as largely represented in politics or government. The family. I want to say a word about the family in Russia. The family is being steadily reinstated in its honored traditional status. The communists, you will recall, were originally hostile to it, contemptuously referred to it as the bourgeois family. The Communist Manifesto of 1848, which is still sort of the Bible of the communism, disparaged the family. On what foundation is the present family, the bourgeois family, based, said the manifesto? On capital, on private gains. The bourgeois family will vanish as a matter of course with the vanishing of capital. But here too, as in many other things, Karl Marx is being proved wrong. The Russian communists, when they first came into power, did proceed to act on the Marxian assumption that the family was a relic of the past. No couple was required to register their marriage, and they separated whenever they wanted. And when a marriage was registered, either party could unregister it by sending a postal card. Divorce was free and easy. Abortion was widely practiced. And sex continence was lightly held. But the facts of life forced a drastic change upon the communists, upon the communist government, in its attitude to the family. A sharp reversal is set in. Today, the family is again not only approved, but acclaimed. Marriage is now surrounded with official ceremony, even if the ceremony is secular in character and not religious. Divorce has been made difficult by numerous legal restrictions. Abortion is banned, and sex laxity is frowned upon. Very interesting that the conventional morality of the present generations of Russians would compare favorably with that of the West. In nearly all things. Also in their literature. The Russian novel is free of that sex exhibitionism of so many contemporary American and continental novels, and the Russian movies as well. One is also impressed with the conventional dress of the young people. No slacks, no jeans, no shorts. You have to come to the United States for it. We were greatly impressed with the young age, with the youth of the people whom we saw on the streets or in the parks and the shops and the theaters and the factories and the farms. Where are the older people, we asked? Many of them, we were told, have been killed off in the war. More than 20 million were killed in the last war in Russia. And many more died of disease and starvation. It is the youth who now dominate the Russian scene. And many of them are crowding into the schools and universities.
eager to become scientists and engineers and technicians and teachers. There's a great hunger among them for education, and the government is encouraging them in every way. The government has practically wiped out illiteracy in a country where 70% of the peasants were illiterate. The government is eager to raise a generation of men and women who will be trained in all branches of science, while not neglecting the humanities and the arts. Education is slanted towards the natural sciences and technology. We visited the great University of Moscow. Its 12 departments housed in 37 buildings. There are nearly 6,000 dormitory rooms for students at the university. The standards and academic disciplines are high and exacting, we were told. Although the subjects which are taught, I believe especially the social sciences, are frequently slanted to conform with communist ideology and party interests, the scholar and research student is not free to arrive at independent conclusions which deviate from the party line. The University of Moscow has a student body of more than 20,000. And they come from 57 nationalities inside and outside the USSR. There are many such universities, smaller in size, of course, throughout the Union. Not nearly as many as in the United States, but impressive, very impressive for Russia. Students who pass the rigorous entrance examinations are not required to pay any tuition fee. On the contrary, they are given small stipends while they study, as well as free board and lodging. The Soviet government has lavished and is lavishing tremendous sums of money upon its scientific academies and upon its scientists. And the results are now clearly evident in the country's amazing achievements in outer space, in rocketry, and in its industrial progress generally. The Russian people are voracious readers. We saw many libraries and bookshops and open-air bookstalls, crowds around them, the young people around them, browsing through the books, buying the books. I was told that new books are quickly sold out, new editions. The classics of world literature have been translated into Russian and are avidly read by the people. American authors like Mark Twain and Jack London and Theodore Dreiser and O. Henry and Upton Sinclair and others are very popular. Up to last year, the works of over 200 American writers had been translated and published, and some 90 million copies were sold. I suspect, you will forgive me for this suspicion, I suspect that the Russian young people know much more about our American literature than our young people know about Tolstoy or Pushkin, Yenev or Chekhov or Gorky. I want to conclude this first report of mine. The second report on religion in Russia, on the position of the Jew and Judaism in Russia, and how the Russians feel about Americans, about coexistence. About war and peace. I will discuss with you next Sunday. But I want to address myself at this moment to the question, are the Russians resentful of their regime? Would they overthrow it if they could? Are they happy? Well, really, it is impossible to answer these questions. You cannot look into the hearts of people, and you cannot take a census. It would be silly to put such questions to the average Russian, as it would be folly for him to answer them, especially to a stranger. Again, it should be remembered, but is frequently overlooked, that there are different kinds of Russians, and that they would naturally react differently to the regime. One can only go by general impressions, and if you are fortunate, by the opinions of people who have been a long time in Russia, whose judgment is valuable, and who are not averse to share their opinions with you. I am sure that there are those in Russia who would like to leave Russia. No doubt about it. But the fundamental fact to remember is that most of the Russians who live today have it better than they had it before. Not better than what we have, but better than what they had before. They haven't many things that they would like to have, but far more than they or their fathers had under the Tsars. They also believe that their government is trying to get them more of the good things of life, that their government is working for them and not against them. The Russians are also very proud of their country's phenomenal progress in recent years. Its heroic victories in the last war over the Nazis, and more especially of the latest scientific achievements of Russia in space, which have amazed the world. On Arbatskaya Square, one of the principal squares in Moscow, one can see huge panels, one after another, on which there are proudly displayed Russia's successive achievements in space, from the first Sputnik in 57 to Gagarin. And I suppose that by now they've added another panel for the phenomenal achievement of Titov. Russians see that. They derive a great deal of pride, national pride, of their country's achievements. Moscow has a permanent exhibition of the economic achievements of the USSR, some 15 large pavilions which we visited, wherein the progress of the country and its new techniques in industry and agriculture and transportation, in atomic power and space rockets are displayed, and thousands of Russians, many of them brought in from surrounding cities and regions, thousands of Russians, young and old, visit this exhibition daily, where guides and instructors tell them about these great achievements of their country. And other cities in the Union have similar exhibits on smaller scales. And this too should be said. The people are also experiencing something of a grateful relaxation from the grim days of Stalin. The terror of the police state has considerably abated. Stalin was feared and by many hated. Khrushchev is not. Stalin's name is now seldom mentioned in Russia. It is all Lenin now. This story goes the rounds. When Stalin died, the members of the Supreme Council wanted to get rid of his body. They wanted it out of the country. And so they inquired of all the neighboring countries whether they would receive Stalin's embalmed body. They all declined. Finally, an inquiry was sent to Ben-Gurion of Israel. Ben-Gurion replied that he would be pleased to accommodate the Soviet government, but he would like to remind them that in Palestine, dead men have been known to come to life again. And so the members of the Supreme Council promptly decided to keep Stalin's body in Moscow. There has unquestionably taken place a definite change in the climate of Russian life. Mr. George F. Kennan, who was formerly our ambassador to the Soviet Union, and who is one of our best informed diplomats, writes in his recent book, Russia and the West Under Lenin and Stalin, the following. I'm inclined to ascribe deep and encouraging significance to some of the changes in the character and structure of the Soviet regime that have taken place since Stalin's death. The drastic alteration in the role of the police has constituted a basic change in the nature and spirit of the Soviet society. It has also altered somewhat the character of the political process, particularly in the senior echelons of the party, away from the horror of unadulterated police intrigue and in the direction of a rudimentary parliamentarism, at least within the Central Committee. The relaxation of the Iron Curtain has to date, he writes, remained within modest limits, but I think it has gone so far that it would not be easy to bottle up again the intellectual and cultural life of this talented people as it was bottled up under Stalin. So I close, dear friend, this first report of mine with this thought. Russia is still a dictatorship, a very tight dictatorship. There can be no doubt about it. The freedoms which we of the Western world cherish are either non-existent or sharply circumscribed. There is but one political party there, and its leaders rule the country with an iron hand. There is no free press. There is no free speech. But it should be remembered that freedom and democracy are precious and have priority in the lives only of those who have known them for a long time and who cannot and do not wish to live without them. This is not the case with the Russians. Their centuries-old tradition is one of dictatorship, in most instances, cruel and exploitative dictatorship. And they can be reconciled. They can be reconciled without any great wrench to any absolutist regime which is not cruel or exploitative, one which they believe works for them and their welfare, and which offers them and their children opportunities which had been denied them in the past. I am therefore inclined to the belief that the Russian people, by and large, while desiring many changes and improvements in their condition, are not
resentful of the regime under which they live, and would not wish to change its fundamentals.